Well, you don't have an order of service in your hand. If you did, you would see that the title of the message this morning is People of the Lie. And the topic that I invite you to explore with me is self-deception. And I'm also going to even use the language of evil, of human evil. So our inquiry this morning asks of us both moral sensitivity and moral seriousness. We also need to approach this topic with some humor and self-care. Self-care as well as care for others. Remember Calvin, it's not denial, I'm just very selective about the reality I accept. Humor and care is essential because to speak of people of the lie, and by that I'm referencing a book which is our starting point this morning, a book by M. Scott Peck called People of the Lie, The Hope for Healing Human Evil. So humor and care is essential because to speak of people of the lie is not just to speak about those other people over there. To speak about people of the lie is to invite self-examination of us, of we people, right here. As we approach this topic, we also need to consider the danger as well as necessity of moral judgment. I say necessity because we who identify with Unitarian Universalism have committed ourselves in entering into membership in this congregation and claiming belonging in our association. We have made a covenant to affirm and promote principles. This is a voluntary covenant, and we who enter into it have chosen to do so. And it is this covenant, Michael, not your minister, that holds us all under judgment. The inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth, free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, and respect for the interdependent web. If we are committed to live with moral sensitivity and moral seriousness, then these principles and our covenant to affirm and promote them must mean something more than just words on a page. The question of the role of a minister was raised this morning. Why did this congregation call a minister? What is the function of a minister? That's a very important question. Traditionally, in my profession, we speak of the pastoral task and the prophetic task. The pastoral task of the minister is to lead the community with compassion and care through the difficult transitions of life, as many of us did last Sunday with the passing of Mike McGinn. And in my pastoral role, I've led a memorial service in this room and on the grounds for an interment ceremony. If that were all that ministry were about, then I would not have chosen this path. There's also what we call the prophetic task or the prophetic imperative. This is a task that goes far beyond our Unitarian Universalist denomination in scope, but it is deeply embedded, in fact, I would say integral, to the Unitarian Universalist tradition. James Luther Adams, one of the early theologians of our tradition responded to Luther's call for the priesthood of all believers with his own call, the prophethood of all believers. The work of being a prophet could be defined in many ways. I defined it as bearing witness to truths, however uncomfortable, that invite the community into the process of work and change. I may have missed the mark. I may have failed in my prophetic work with this community. And if I did, I can own that. But my intent in writing what I've written is to hold us accountable to our covenant and to remind us that we are a moral community and that our principles hold us all under judgment, whether we're willing to admit that or not when we make a public stand for who we are. The community outside of these walls looks to us and judges us as to whether we live into those principles or not. Scott Peck has dedicated a whole section. He addresses it right up front and then spends more time in the body of the book addressing the danger of moral judgment. I've talked about the necessity. Let's reflect on the danger with Scott Peck's wisdom. As has been noted, it's characteristic of those who are evil to judge others as evil. Unable to acknowledge their own imperfection, they must explain away their flaws by blaming others. And if necessary, they will even destroy others in the name of righteousness. How often have we seen it? The martyrdom of the saints, the Inquisition, the Holocaust, may lie. Often enough to know that whenever we judge another as evil, we may ourselves be committing evil. Even atheists and agnostics believe in Christ's words, "Judge not, that ye not be judged." Evil is a moral judgment. This is Scott Peck writing here. I'm proposing that it may also be a scientific judgment. By making the judgment scientifically, we'll not remove it from the moral sphere. The word is pejorative, just as wimp is pejorative. Word that I've used. Whether we call a man evil on the basis of pure opinion or on the basis of a standardized psychological test, we're passing a moral judgment on him either way. Had we best not refrain from doing either? Science is dangerous enough. Moral judgment is dangerous enough. How dare we mix the two in light of Jesus' admonition? Stay with me. I think this is an important passage given what's unfolding. If we examine the matter more closely, however, we'll see that it is both impossible and itself evil to totally refrain from making moral judgments. An attitude of "I'm okay, you're okay" may have a certain place in facilitating our social relationships, but only a place. Was Hitler okay? Lieutenant Calley, the one officer involved in the perpetration of My Lai, was he okay? Jim Jones? Were the medical experiments conducted on the Jews in German concentration camps okay? The LSD experiments conducted by the CIA? Let's also look at everyday life. If I'm to hire an employee, should I take the first person who comes along, or should I interview a number of applicants and judge between them? What kind of father would I be if I discovered my son cheating, lying, or stealing, and I failed to criticize him? What should I tell a friend who is planning suicide or a patient who is selling heroin? You're okay? There is such a thing as an excess of sympathy, an excess of tolerance, an excess of permissiveness. The fact of the matter is we cannot lead decent lives without making judgment in general and moral judgments in particular. When patients come to see me, what they pay me for is my presumably good judgment. When I seek legal advice, I'm interested in the quality of my lawyer's judgment. Do we spend $5,000 on a family vacation or invest it in saving for the children's education? Do I or do I not cheat on my income tax? You and I go through our day making decisions that are judgments, most of which have moral overtones. We cannot escape from judging. The sentence, "Judge not that ye not be judged," is usually quoted out of context. Christ did not enjoin us to refrain from ever judging. What he went on to say in the next four verses is that we should judge ourselves before we judge others. Not that we shouldn't judge at all. "Thou hypocrite," he said, "first cast out the beam of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of the brother's eye." Recognizing the potential for evil and moral judgments, he instructed us not to always avoid making them, but to purify ourselves before doing so. Which is where the evil fail. It is in the self-criticism that they avoid. So this morning I speak of a reality that I have come to accept as true after a search through diverse sources, direct experience, wisdom from the world's religious traditions, as well as the results of science, specifically the science of psychiatry and psychology. World scripture has much to say about lying and deceit. Proverbs: "Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord." Taoism: "Do not assert with your mouth what your heart denies." The Talmud: "No man should walk one way with his lips and think another way in his heart." The Sikh, the holy book, Adi Granth: "Dishonesty in business or the uttering of lies causes inner sorrow." Islam, in the Quran, the holy book: "O you who believe, wherefore do you say what you do not? Very hateful it is to God that you say what you do not." Buddhism, in the Dhammapada: "A speaker of falsehood reaches purgatory, and again so does one who, having done a misdeed, says, 'I did not.' Both of them, men of base deeds, become equal in the other world." Actually, the Buddhist tradition has much to say about embracing false views. From the Maharanatkatutra Sutra: "A liar lies to himself as well as to the gods. Lying is the origin of all evils. It leads to rebirth in the miserable planes of existence, to breach of the pure precepts, and to corruption of the body." There's a trove of scientific literature on self-deception. The Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen coined the phrase "vital lie" for the comforting story we tell ourselves that hides a more painful truth. Daniel Goleman popularized the phrase in his best-selling book, "Vital Lies, Simple Truths: A Psychology of Self-Deception." An internet search reveals dozens, maybe hundreds, of books published by psychologists and psychiatrists. I found in my research a book by Dr. Courtney Warren, PhD, clinical psychologist, and a website. Her website is called Choose Honesty. Her book, Lies We Tell Ourselves. Dr. Warren says this: we deceive ourselves because we don't have enough psychological strength to admit the truth and deal with the consequences that will follow. Yet understanding our self-deceptive nature is the most efficient, effective way to live a fulfilling life. For when we acknowledge who we really are, we have the opportunity to change. Dr. Warren notes of the costs of self-deception, and she names three I think are particularly useful for our own self-examination and reflection. The first cost, she says, of self-deception is we hurt ourselves and those we love the most when we don't take full responsibility for who we are. The second cost is we can contribute to large-scale acts of cruelty by believing our lies and spreading them to others. The third cost is that self-deception can leave us with massive amounts of regret. Now, some will argue, and it's out there in the literature, that there is a case for self-deception and lying to oneself, if not on moral grounds, then more for pragmatic reasons. Psychology professor at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Dale Paul Huss, has authored a widely used measure of self-deceptiveness. And he argues that self-deception isn't just lying or faking. It's more complicated and deeper than that. Sometimes we keep ourselves from acknowledging a threatening truth about ourselves because it helps us function better in the world. This is actually Daniel Goleman's argument behind vital lies, that we embrace vital lies because we don't have the capacity to cope with the anxiety of facing these difficult truths. So it's a coping mechanism, and we all have different capacities to hold anxiety. Robert Trivers from Rutgers wrote the book, The Folly of Fools, says that believing we are more talented or intelligent than we really are can help us influence and win over others, and gives the example of an executive who talks himself into believing he's a great public speaker, or even a minister for that matter. May not only feel better as he performs, but can actually increase that person's capacity to fool people by having a confident style that persuades them that he's good. I'll be honest, sometimes I don't want to come here on Sunday mornings. I have to persuade myself to be here, not because I like it, because I need it. This was one of those days, actually. I wanted to stay home. Well, I brought the book People of the Lie into this service because it has been an important book for me personally, and it's shaped my ministry. Scott Peck is no saint. He writes honestly about his own infidelity, even after talking as a moral exemplar in the book The Road Less Traveled about the importance of a disciplined and responsible life. But he is an honest man, he was, and an insightful one at that. On page 232 in the book, The People of the Lie, in the middle of a chapter that is a case study on me lie, an examination of group evil, Scott Peck writing as one who served as an army psychiatrist during Vietnam. He offers a definition of evil and embeds it within a larger understanding of U.S. militarism. He says this: if we must have a military at all, it should hurt. Should is in italics. As a people, we should not toy with the means of mass destruction without being willing to personally bear the responsibility of wielding them. If we must kill, let us not select and train hired killers to do the dirty job for us and then forget that there's any blood involved. If we must kill, then let us honestly suffer the agony involved ourselves. Otherwise, we will insulate ourselves from our own deeds. And as a whole people, we will become evil. For evil arises in the refusal to acknowledge our own sins. Can you let me finish, Michael? You want to say something? Oh. This speaks truth for me, a truth so powerful in my life that I volunteered to serve as a chaplain in the U.S. Army and go to Afghanistan. As a son of a Vietnam veteran, I grew up in an insulated family that would not discuss or acknowledge the pain and the tragedy of that war. I decided my life would be different. This struggle to face the real agony of our killing, to confront vital lies, led me to deliver a sermon in Afghanistan, a confession, a Veterans Day confession for America, which I delivered 6 years ago in Kandahar. I've experienced scapegoating. I was targeted and attacked for a sermon that I gave, for pointing out uncomfortable truths. I was attacked, as I feel I've been attacked this morning. This struggle, I understand it as a struggle to deliver us all from evil, as defined as M. Scott Peck defines it, the refusal to acknowledge our own sins. Sin is a difficult word, but one that we need to approach even in our own terms. Most broadly construed, sin is missing the mark. And when we covenant to affirm and promote principles that are grandiose, it's inevitable that we will miss the mark. This struggle was the basis of my doctoral dissertation and my ongoing work in the Department of Veterans Affairs around moral injury. Tomorrow, I will be in Philadelphia leading the fourth community healing ceremony. Some of you have opted to be there, and I'm grateful for that. In that ceremony, I have the program here. Veterans bear witness to painful and uncomfortable truths about the consequences of our militarism and our killing. The community listens and responds in confession. The confession, which I will lead the community in tomorrow, goes something like this. We sent you into harm's way. You were willing to go for me, for my family, and for our nation. We put you into situations where atrocities were possible. We asked you to be willing to do the unthinkable, to commit the unspeakable, to bear the unbearable. We lament, we grieve, we confess our culpability and our complicity. For lives lost, resources wasted and misused, pain suffered and inflicted, the earth scorched, contaminated and made uninhabitable, families broken, communities devastated, trust betrayed, souls wounded. We share responsibility with you for all that you've seen, all that you've done, and all that you've failed to do. We affirm our duty to care, seek understanding, and change. We lift up the burden from your shoulders and carry it with you. You're not alone. We're companions on this journey. Welcome home. That is a community confession that's embedded in our order of service. So I'll end with a word of hope. Scott Peck's book is about the hope for healing human evil. Where is the hope? I find hope in the ceremony that I lead, in the community that confesses and owns responsibility for falling short and for missing the mark. Scott Peck calls the twin progenitors of evil laziness and narcissism, and says each individual's responsibility is to continually examine himself or herself for laziness and narcissism, and then purify ourselves accordingly. The hope is in our vigilance, in our self-awareness, our willingness to examine ourselves as individuals and as a community. The hope is in our capacity to expose and restrain laziness and narcissism, and by doing the difficult work of self-examination and the difficult work of moral repair, practicing spiritual disciplines that facilitate purification and cleansing, confessing, repenting, forgiving ourselves and others. Restitution, reconciliation, recommitment. Difficult, maybe impossible, to do this work in isolation. Ultimately, I am convinced that the hope for healing human evil and rising above our all-too-human tendencies rests in religious communities like this one.